Chapter 31, Balaam. The Israelites moved forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side of Jordan by Jericho. Balak, the king of the Moabites, saw that the Israelites were a powerful people, and as they learned that they had destroyed the Amorites and had taken possession of their land, they were exceedingly terrified. All Moab was in trouble, and Moab said unto the elders of Midian, "Now shall this company lick up all that are around about us, as the ox licketh up the grass of the field." He sent messengers therefore unto Balaam the son of Beor to Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of his people, to call him, saying, "Behold, there is a people come out from Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Come now, therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail, that we may smite them, and that I may drive them out of the land. For I wot that he whom thou blessest is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed." Balaam had been a prophet of God and a good man, but he apostatized and gave himself up to covetousness, so that he loved the wages of unrighteousness. At the time Balak sent messengers for him, he was double-minded, pursuing a course to gain and retain the favor and honor of the enemies of the Lord for the sake of rewards he received from them. At the same time, he was professing to be a prophet of God. Idolatrous nations believed that curses might be uttered which would affect individuals and even whole nations. As the messengers related their message to Balaam, he very well knew what answer to give them. But he asked them to tarry that night, and he would bring them word as the Lord should speak unto him. The presence in the hands of the men excited his covetous disposition. God came to Balaam in the night through one of his angels and inquired of him, "What men are these with thee?" And Balaam said unto God, "Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent unto me, saying, 'Behold, there is a people come out of Egypt, which covereth the face of the earth. Come now, curse me them. Peradventure I shall be able to overcome them and drive them out.' And God said unto Balaam, 'Thou shalt not go with them. Thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed.' The angel tells Balaam that the children of Israel are conducted under the banner of the God of heaven, and no curse from man could retard their progress. In the morning he arose and reluctantly told the men to return to Balak, for the Lord would not suffer him to go with them. Then Balak sent other princes, more of them in number and more honorable, or occupying a more exalted position than the former messengers, and this time Balak's call was more urgent. "Let nothing, I pray thee, hinder thee coming unto me, for I will promote thee unto very great honor, and I will do whatsoever thou sayest unto me. Come therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people." And Balaam answered and said unto the servants of Balak, "If Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more." His fear of God's power holds the ascendancy over his covetous disposition. Yet his course of conduct shows that his love of honor and gain was striving hard for the mastery, and he did not subdue it. He would have gratified his covetousness if he had dared to do it. After God had said that he should not go, he was anxious to be granted the privilege of going. He urged them to remain that night, that he might make inquiry again of God. An angel was sent to Balaam to say unto him, "If the men come to call thee, rise up and go with them. Yet the word which I shall say unto thee, that shalt thou do." The Lord suffered Balaam to follow his own inclinations and try, if he chose so to do, to please both God and man. The messengers of Balak did not call upon him in the morning to have him go with them. They were annoyed with his delay and expected a second refusal. Balaam could have excused himself and easily avoided going, but he thought that because the Lord the second time did not forbid his going, he would go and overtake the ambassadors of Balak. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Balaam because he went, and he sent his angel to stand in the way and to slay him for his presumptuous folly. The beast saw the angel of the Lord and turned aside. Balaam was beside himself with rage. the speaking of the beast was unnoticed by him as anything remarkable, for he was blinded by passion. As the angel revealed himself to Balaam, he was terrified and left his beast and bowed in humility before the angel. He related to Balaam the word of the Lord and said, I went out to withstand thee because thy way is perverse before me. It was important to Israel to overcome the Moabites in order to overcome the inhabitants of Canaan. After the angel had impressively warned Balaam against gratifying the Moabites, he gave him permission to pursue his journey. God would glorify his name even through the presumptuous Balaam before the enemies of Israel. This could not be done in a more effectual manner than by showing them that a man of Balaam's covetous disposition dared not, for any promises of promotion or rewards, pronounce a curse against Israel. Balak met Balaam and inquired of him why he thus delayed to come when he sent for him, and told him that he had power to promote him to honor. Balaam answered, Lo, I am come unto thee. He then told him he had no power to say anything. The word that God should give him, that could he speak, and could go no further. Balaam ordered the sacrifices according to the religious rites. God sent his angel to meet with Balaam to give him words of utterance, as he had done on occasions when Balaam was wholly devoted to the service of God. And the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, Return unto Balak, and thus thou shalt speak. And he returned unto him, and lo, he stood by his burnt sacrifices, he and all the princes of Moab. And he took up his parable and said, Balak the king of Moab hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east, saying, Come curse me Jacob, and come defy Israel. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed, or how shall I defy whom the Lord hath not defied? For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell alone, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob, and the number of the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his. Balaam spoke in a solemn, prophetic style. How shall I defy or devote to destruction those whom God hath promised to prosper? He declared in prophetic words that Israel should remain a distinct people, that they should not be united with, swallowed up by, or lost in any other nation, that they would become far more numerous than they then were, and he related their prosperity and strength. He saw that the end of the righteous was truly desirable, and prophetically expressed his desire that his life might end like theirs. Balak was disappointed and angry. He exclaims, What hast thou done unto me? I took thee to curse mine enemies, and behold, thou hast blessed them altogether. Balak thinks it is the grand appearance of the Israelites in their tents, which Balaam views from a high mount, that keeps him from cursing them. He thinks if he takes him to another place where Israel will not appear to such advantage, he can obtain a curse from Balaam. Again at Zophim, at the top of Pisgah, Balaam offered burnt offerings and then went by himself to commune with the angel of God. And the angel told Balaam what to say. When he returned, Balak inquired anxiously, What hath the Lord spoken? And he took up his parable and said, Rise up, Balak, and hear. Hearken unto me, thou son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. Hath he said, and shall he not do it? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good? Behold, I have received commandment to bless, and he hath blessed, and I cannot reverse it. He hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob, neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. God brought them out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. Surely there is no enchantment against Jacob, neither is there any divination against Israel. According to this time it shall be said of Jacob and of Israel, What hath God wrought? Behold, the people shall rise up as a great lion, and lift himself up as a young lion. He shall not lie down until he eat of the prey and drink the blood of the slain. Balak still flattered himself with the vain hope that God was subject to variation like man. Balaam informs him that God will never be induced to break his word or alter his purpose concerning Israel, and that it is in vain for him to hope to obtain a curse for his people, or to expect him to reverse the blessing he has promised to them. And no enchantment or curse uttered by a diviner could have the least influence upon that nation that has the protection of omnipotence. Balaam had wished to appear to be favorable to Balak, and had permitted him to be deceived and think that he used superstitious ceremonies and enchantments when he besought the Lord. But as he followed out the command given him of God, he grew bolder in proportion as he obeyed the divine impulse, and he laid aside his pretended conjuration, and looking toward the encampment of the Israelites, he beholds them all encamped in perfect order under their respective standards at a distance from the tabernacle. Balaam was permitted to behold the glorious manifestation of God's presence, overshadowing, protecting, and guiding the tabernacle. He was filled with admiration at the sublime scene. Chapter 32. Death of Moses. Moses was soon to die, and he was commanded of God before his death to gather the children of Israel together and relate to them all the journeyings of the Hebrew host since their departure from Egypt, and all the great transgressions of their fathers which brought his judgments upon them and compelled him to say that they should not enter the promised land. Their fathers had died in the wilderness according to the word of the Lord. Their children had grown up, and to them the promise was to be fulfilled of possessing the land of Canaan. Many of these were small children when the law was given, and they had no remembrance of the grandeur of the event. Others were born in the wilderness, and lest they should not realize the necessity of their obeying the Ten Commandments and all the laws and judgments given to Moses, he was instructed of God to recapitulate the Ten Commandments and all the circumstances connected with the giving of the law. Moses had written in a book all the laws and judgments given him of God, and had faithfully recorded all his instruction given them by the way, and all the miracles which he had performed for them, and all the murmurings of the children of Israel. Moses had also recorded his being overcome in consequence of their murmurings. All the people were assembled before him, and he read the events of their past history out of the book which he had written. He read also the promises of God to them if they would be obedient, and the curses which would come upon them if they were disobedient. He related to the people his great sorrow because of his fault at Meribah. And I besought the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, thou hast begun to show thy servant thy greatness and thy mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or in earth that can do according to thy works and according to thy might? I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain and Lebanon. But the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes, and would not hear me. And the Lord said unto me, Let it suffice thee, speak no more unto me of this matter. Get thee up into the top of Pisgah, and lift up thine eyes westward and northward and southward and eastward, and behold it with thine eyes, for thou shalt not go over this Jordan. But charge Joshua, and encourage him, and strengthen him, for he shall go over before this people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which thou shalt see. Now therefore hearken, O Israel, unto the statutes and unto the judgments which I teach you, for to do them, that ye may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers giveth you. Ye shall not add unto the word which I command you, neither shall ye diminish aught from it, that ye may keep the commandments of the Lord your God which I command you. Moses told them that for their rebellion the Lord had several times purposed to destroy them, but he had interceded for them so earnestly that God had graciously spared them. He reminded them of the miracle which the Lord did unto Pharaoh and all the land of Egypt. He said to them, But your eyes have seen all the great acts of the Lord which he did. Therefore shall ye keep all the commandments which I command you this day, that ye may be strong and go in and possess the land whither ye go to possess it. Moses especially warned the children of Israel against being seduced into idolatry. He earnestly charged them to obey the commandments of God. If they would prove obedient and love the Lord and serve Him with their undivided affections, He would give them rain in due season and cause their vegetation to flourish and increase their cattle. They should also enjoy special and exalted privileges and should triumph over their enemies. He related to them the advantages of the land of Canaan over that of Egypt. In certain seasons of the year, the cultivated lands in Egypt had to be watered from the river by machinery which was worked by the foot. This was a laborious process. Moses said to them, "For the land whither thou goest in to possess it is not as the land of Egypt from whence ye came out, where thou sowest thy seed and waterest it with thy foot as a garden of herbs. But the land whither ye go to possess it is a land of hills and valleys, and drinketh water of the rain of heaven, a land which the Lord thy God careth for. The eyes of the Lord thy God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year even unto the end of the year." Many of the Egyptians paid that devotion to the river which belonged alone to God. They acknowledged it as their God because they were dependent on its waters to quench their thirst and to use upon their lands to cause vegetation to flourish, and it liberally supplied their tables with fish. During the plagues on Egypt, Pharaoh was punctual in his superstitious devotion to the river and visited every morning, and as he stood upon the banks, he offered praise and thanksgiving to the water, recounting the great good it accomplished and telling the water of its great power, that without it they could not exist, for their lands were watered by it, and it supplied meat for their tables. The first plague which visited Egypt was to come upon the waters, one of the exalted gods of Pharaoh. Moses smote the waters before Pharaoh and his great men, and they saw the waters which they were adoring turn to blood. It was a putrid mass for 7 days, and all the fish that were in it died. The people could not use the water for any purpose. Moses instructed the children of Israel in an earnest, impressive manner. He knew that it was his last opportunity to address them. He then finished writing in a book all the laws, judgments, and statutes which God had given him, also the various regulations respecting sacrificial offerings. He placed the book in the hands of men in the sacred office and requested that for safekeeping it should be put in the side of the ark, for God's care was continually upon that sacred chest. This book of Moses was to be preserved that the judges of Israel might refer to it if any case should come up to make it necessary. An erring people often understand God's requirements to suit their own case. Therefore, the book of Moses was preserved in a most sacred place for future reference. Moses closed his last instructions to the people by a most powerful prophetic address. It was pathetic and eloquent. By inspiration of God, he blessed separately the tribes of Israel. In his closing words, he dwelt largely upon the majesty of God and the excellency of Israel, which would ever continue if they would obey God and take hold of His strength. He said to them, "There is none like unto the God of Jeshurun, who rideth upon the heaven in thy help, and in His excellency on the sky. The eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. And He shall thrust out the enemy from before thee, and shall say, Destroy them. Israel then shall dwell in safety alone. The fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine, also his heaven shall drop down dew. Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee, O people saved by the Lord, the shield of thy help, and who is the sword of thy excellency. And thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee, and thou shalt tread upon their high places." Joshua was selected of God to be Moses' successor in leading the Hebrew host to the Promised Land. He was most solemnly consecrated to the future important work of leading as a faithful shepherd the people of Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands upon him. And the children of Israel hearkened unto him and did as the Lord commanded Moses. And he gave Joshua charge before all the congregation of Israel. Be strong and of a good courage, for thou shalt bring the children of Israel unto the land which I swear unto them, and I will be with thee. He spoke to Joshua in God's stead. He also had the elders and officers of the tribes gathered before him, and he solemnly charged them to deal justly and righteously in their religious offices, and to faithfully obey all the instructions he had given them from God. He called heaven and earth to record against them, that if they should depart from God and transgress his commandments, he was clear, for he had faithfully instructed and warned them. And Moses went up from the plains of Moab unto the mountain of Nebo to the top of Pisgah, that is over against Jericho, and the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead unto Dan, and all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim, and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah unto the utmost sea, and the south, and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees unto Zoar. And the Lord said unto him, This is the land which I swear unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. So Moses, a servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab over against Beth Peor, and no man knoweth of his sepulchre unto this day. And Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. Moses ascended to Pisgah, the highest prominence of the mountain which he could attain, and there his clear and undimmed eyes viewed the land, the promised home of Israel. God opened before his sight the whole land of Canaan. He there in the mount fully realized the rich blessings Israel would enjoy if they would faithfully obey the commandments of God. It was not the will of God that anyone should go up with Moses to the top of Pisgah. There he stood upon a high prominence upon Pisgah's top in the presence of God and heavenly angels. After he had viewed Canaan to his satisfaction, he lay down like a tired warrior to rest. Sleep came upon him, but it was the sleep of death. Angels took his body and buried it in the valley. The Israelites could never find the place where he was buried. His secret burial was to prevent the people from sinning against the Lord by committing idolatry over his body. Moses had accomplished much for Israel. In all his instructions to them could be seen justice, intelligence, and purity. The life of Moses was marked with supreme love to God. His piety, humility, and forbearance gave him influence with the host of Israel. His zeal and faith in God were greater than those of any other man upon the earth. He had often addressed his people in words of stirring eloquence. No one knew better than he how to move the affections of the people. He conducted all matters connected with the religious interests of the people with great wisdom. Satan exulted that he had succeeded in causing Moses to sin against God. For this transgression, Moses came under the dominion of death. If he had continued faithful and his life had not been marred with that one transgression, in failing to give to God the glory of bringing water from the rock, he would have entered the promised land and would have been translated to heaven without seeing death. Michael, or Christ, with the angels that buried Moses, came down from heaven after he had remained in the grave a short time and resurrected him and took him to heaven. As Christ and the angels approached the grave, Satan and his angels appeared at the grave and were guarding the body of Moses, lest it should be removed. As Christ and his angels drew near, Satan resisted their approach, but was compelled by the glory and power of Christ and his angels to fall back. Satan claimed the body of Moses because of his one transgression, but Christ meekly referred him to his Father, saying, The Lord rebuke thee. Christ told Satan that he knew that Moses had humbly repented of this one wrong, and no stain rested upon his character, and his name in the heavenly book of records stood untarnished. Then Christ resurrected the body of Moses which Satan had claimed. at the transfiguration of Christ, Moses was sent with Elijah, who had been translated to talk with Christ in regard to his sufferings and be the bearers of God's glory to his dear son. Moses had been greatly honored of God. He had been privileged to talk with God face to face as a man speaketh with his friend. And God had revealed to him his excellent glory as he had never done to any other.